You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
And welcome to Connecting the Dots, Christos and Esti.
Happy Easter.
Happy Easter. Christ is risen. And yep. He is risen indeed. And we are here on Connecting the Dots back again after our four-day hiatus because I took Holy Thursday and Good Friday off because, you know, I'm a super goody two-shoes Catholic.
And, you are. I have an Easter joke for you.
I'm ready.
Okay. You know what Jesus' first two words were after the resurrection? Ta-da! I know. It's just so stupid.
That's like a third grade Easter joke. Man.
You laughed.
I did laugh. I am a third grader in my sense of humor.
My father told that to me, and I was like, what?
Well, you know, yeah, I figure you got to feel great, you know?
Yeah.
Jesus must have felt, I wonder what it was like, you know, just rising from the dead. You just got to feel like.
That's got to be it today. If there's a ta-da moment, that's going to be it.
I'm so glad that's over, you know?
Yeah.
That reminds me, not really an Easter joke.
Okay.
But it always cracks me up. But this is a super theological inside baseball joke for Catholics who know about Calvinism but are not Calvinist. Although I think I know some Calvinists who would find this joke funny, too.
For Catholic nerds, go ahead.
Okay. This is a super nerdy joke. What did the Calvinist say after he fell down the stairs?
I don't know.
Well, I'm glad that's over with. That is secretly hilarious if you know about Calvinism. Yes. Predestination. That's why that joke is funny. So it was ordained from the foundation of the world that I fall down the stairs, and now that's over with. So good. So anyway,
insert your religious jokes here.
I was doing this show with Steve Gardonis a couple of weeks ago, and his wife Suzanne always faithfully listens to the show while she's doing whatever it is she's doing in the other part of the house. She's got it on the computer and she's listening in, and apparently one of their like their third grader or something was listening to the show along with her. She was doing thing. And Steve got a text message in the middle of the show from Suze downstairs saying, informing him that their third grader said that basically our show was two dorks laughing at their own jokes. Which is not. I'm thinking about actually changing the name of the show from Connecting the Dots to Two Dorks Laughing at Their Own Jokes. I think that's a great title for this show. Except
I think so. And you know what? I don't think I'm going to let any of my children hear this show. I'm going to tell them I can't listen for that very reason.
It's too late. You're a dork, and you just told me a really dumb joke. So.
Well, they could have told me I was a dork long before this show. There's plenty of evidence out there.
There it is.
You know,
so anyway,
go ahead.
How was your Easter?
It was a lot of fun. We had 9 o'clock mass, and my children wound up bringing up the gifts, and so that was very moving to watch them do that. And then we had roast lamb and rice cauliflower and French bread and Caesar salad and pumpkin upside down cake for dessert and oodles of chocolate and had the obligatory food coma afterwards. It was a lot of fun. But the best part was my children enacted the scene from The Princess Bride to the pain.
To the Okay.
With their Easter bunnies. So now there's a pair of perfectly shaped Easter bunny ears in my refrigerator, wallowing in freakish misery forever. Yeah. So.
Speaking of dumb third grade jokes, one of my favorite Easter cartoons is the two chocolate bunnies.
Yes.
It has a bite out of its bottom, and the other one is missing its ears.
Yeah, one, and one says, and
out, it's out of this, my butt hurts, and the other one says, what?
Yes.
That is super stupid joke.
It is a great joke.
That joke, it's so dumb.
Yes.
So
there you go. That was my Easter.
Yeah. So. So, well, I had the perfect consummation to Lent last week. So all of Lent was spent, or not all of Lent, all of Holy Week was spent doing the thing that I always have to do this time of year, along with all other Americans everywhere, my taxes. Now, to clarify, all other Americans don't have to do my taxes, although that would be really nice if they would just do that for me. And
send in your tax donations too.
Just do my taxes. Just figure them out for me. Yeah, if they want to pay them too, that would be great. But so I sat there struggling all week long doing my self-employment taxes, and it's just murder. Yes. Every year, my kids, go, yeah, I guess I got to do my taxes. So they like sit down with their piddly little 1040 EZ form and their one, two that they have to fill in. And they're like utterly non-complex taxes. And they're done in like 15 minutes.
Yes.
My children so much because of that. And I'm trying to think of ways that I can kill them or torture them or make them in some way. But no, I just sat there doing my taxes all week long, and it was just anguish. I'm not making this up. I was at Holy Thursday, and like after I went up for communion, I think, or something. Yeah, it was after I went up for communion. Well, just before I went up for communion, I started to notice that I could not see the hymnal in front of me when I looked at it directly. My field of vision, right in the center of my field of vision in both eyes, so it tells me there was something going on in my brain, was just like a blind spot there.
That's scary.
Yeah, it was worrisome. And then as Mass went on, it like changed and slowly sort of moved off to the upper left-hand side of my field of vision was this. But then it kind of spread, and it was just this weird blind spot in my field of vision. And that used to happen to me when I was like a teenager. I used to have that happen. And so I one time, I don't mean to be giving you like my whole medical history here, but it's just a curious thing. One time I had my, When I had my first eye exam when I was about, I don't know, close to 30, somewhere in my late 20s, because my vision was just getting terrible. And so I went and had my eyes examined. It turned out I had astigmatism. And so they do the thing where they put eye drops in your eye.
Yeah.
And they put your chin on this kind of chin brace thing, and then they wheel this machine in and they put it up to your eye, and you're supposed to look through it at the big blue light.
Yes.
And so I sat there and looked at the big blue light, and I didn't know what they were doing. But after they took the machine away, suddenly I went into shock.
Ooh.
And I thought I was going to pass out. They had me lean back against the chair, and I just laid there for a while. And, it was like everything just kind of went white. And I thought, what is happening to me? So what they told me was what the big blue light thing is, which I didn't know. But part of what they do, the reason they put the drops in your eyes is to numb your eyeball. And then what they do is while you're looking at the big blue light, they like poke your eyeball.
Ah!
It's a glaucoma test. It's to test the pressure inside of your eyeball.
Well,
I didn't feel anything, but my body registered that eyeball poke, and then my whole cardiovascular system just kind of clamped down.
It's kind of like a Star Trek episode. You wake up and something's been done. You've been probed.
Something was done to me, you know. So anyway, I talked to an eye doctor like years later, and he said, yeah, that can be an issue when you're younger because your cardiovascular system is like hypersensitive. But as you get older, then your cardiovascular system just goes, whatever, you know.
You so broke your eye, I'll get over it.
Yeah, and then you don't have these problems, right? So anyway, and sure enough, as I'd gotten older, when I went for eye tests, that didn't happen anymore and all that stuff. Well, anyway, what he said was, yeah, so you might have just a particularly, you know, acute cardiovascular system. And one of the things that can happen is that your cardiovascular system and your brain can do that sometimes. And so it'll just clamp down on, in some cases, your visual cortex. And so you'll have these weird episodes where you just can't see things for a little bit because you're under a lot of stress and your cardiovascular system is doing that. So anyway, that happened on Thursday night at Holy Thursday. And I just thought, Jen said, well, you have been under a lot of stress. I thought, yeah, I think that's probably it. When I stepped outside after Mass was over and just walked a few feet, it all cleared up and I could see fine and everything's been great since then. But it was a brutal week. Oh. And I will tell about what happened on Holy Saturday when we returned. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Day, and we are here today with Sherry Antonetti. We're talking about Easter, and we will be talking about one of the curious relics of Easter when we return on Connecting the Dots. Back in just a minute. Bye-bye.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Welcome back to Connect the Dots. I am thy host, Mark Shea.
And I am thy guest host.
Yes. And that is Sherry Antonetti speaking in her native English language to us all here.
We're going to bring back the thes and thys. It'll be much nicer.
Right. So I had this weird thing because it was such a stressful week. But then got all the taxes done. And thanks be to God. Got not only the taxes finished, we took a hit, but then they want estimated taxes. Whenever you owe taxes, if you're self-employed, then they want you to magically know how much money you're going to make in the next year, which you never actually really know. Of course, you don't. You just don't have a clue. But you're supposed to guess, and basically what that works out to is whatever you made last year, it is, of course, a foregone conclusion. You will make exactly the same amount as that coming year. And so whatever you paid in taxes, you have to pay again in estimated taxes. So we took a fairly decent hit of about $4,400 and, you know, paid all that. But that means now I do not have to think about taxes for another year. And next year, when taxes come, I will be able to tell them, yeah, I already paid you guys, $2,200. So knock that off of my tax bill. So I don't have to think about that. Got the property taxes done. And it was just like this huge weight off my shoulders. And then on Saturday, so the weather finally turned here in Washington. So we had blue sky, big puffy white clouds, and the granddaughters all came over.
Aww.
All three of them come over, and they did Easter eggs. And it would just turned out to be this magnificent party picnic day on Holy Saturday with little girls making Easter eggs, and they had their pretty frilly dresses. And then we all went out in the backyard and we laid out a big blanket and we had a picnic, and the girls had a magnificent time. My oldest granddaughter is about 7 years old, and her two little cousins are 3 and 1. And so they came over and they played hide and seek with grandma and with me and with Peter, our third son, who is a big golden retriever of a kid. And it was just so wonderful. You laid out there in the sun and you just savored how gorgeous it was. And we were going to go to the vigil that evening, which we did. And the vigil was stunning. And then got up the next morning. I've been to the vigil. I don't have to do anything. It's Sunday morning. So
the day of rest. Yes.
It's day of rest. And so I'm just going to go out, and I took a walk and I read my book, reading a really fun science fiction novel called The January Dancer by Michael Flynn. And so wandered around and read my, I'm one of those people that likes to walk and read.
Nice.
And so I just walked around the neighborhood on all the back streets, and there's no traffic because it's Easter Sunday morning and there's nothing happening anywhere. The whole world is at peace. And then we had had the kids all over again for Easter Sunday.
So and, do you do ham or lamb for your Easter feast?
We did ham. Well, we did ham and omelets. So and I finally, of course, I broke my fast, so I got to eat nice chocolatey things, and somebody brought a big old honking cheesecake that was magnificent. And
I bet
I did all these things for one day that a diabetic is not supposed to do, because I just don't care. This is Easter, yeah, and I'm gonna enjoy myself. So I did, and it was just, it was great. Yeah. And it was just such a sweet, restful, good time. And so,
that's good.
Yeah. And I don't know. It was like, you get that, you know, now and again, you get those moments where it just kind of feels like a bone that was out of joint kind of pops back into place. And you just think, oh yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Much better. Yes.
So that was how it was. You know, that was how it was. It was just, it's been an extremely stressful Lent for me, which I guess, you know, that's kind of how Lent should be, I suppose. Good and penitential. But yeah, so I've just been thanking God and praising God. Just, you thank God for stuff that God gives you and does for you, but you praise God for who he is in himself. And
yes,
and I've been praising God, just, you know, remembering that God is good, and whatever the circumstances are, God remains God and God remains good. And sometimes things suck, but that doesn't mean that God has stopped being good.
No, and I will tell you that Maryland is one of those places that spring is just an explosive riot of color. Every tree is in bloom. So you've got these pink petals that are like snowing onto the road because the wind blows. And it's just, it's magnificent. It's
wonderful.
Bucolic. I mean, it's hard to come up with the right words, because every time I see it, I'm like blown away, because there's just so much color and it's everywhere, and it's such a magnificent, I want to say, opulent display of beauty that you can't, you know, it's like the whole earth is singing about Easter because every tree looks like an Easter egg. It's just magnificent. And I grew up where that just isn't so. You get beautiful blue bonnets and you get wildflowers that are gorgeous, but the trees don't bloom in Texas except for like the azaleas bushes, you know, but you don't get this kind of pear trees and dogwoods and cherry trees and just these Japanese lilac thingies, and it just, it's everywhere, and it just is, and forsythia, it's just every color and it's gorgeous.
Yeah.
And so I will go outside and just feel like, you know, the all of earth is screaming, he is risen.
Yeah. God just showing off, you know.
Yes. Let's plant a happy tree here. You know, kind of a thing.
Wonderful. Oh, I love it. Yeah. So, it's just, it's been a great Easter. And I'm one of those people that, like, you know, during the 12 days of Christmas, I milk that. I was raised in a household where it is Christmas from roughly, well, the day after Thanksgiving.
Uh-huh. Until
midnight on Christmas Day. And then after that, it's just winter.
Oh,
and when I became Catholic, it was like a big discovery for me to find out that
we got 11 more days. Let's go.
We got 11 more days. Yeah, it's funny, you know, because you hear all this stuff these days, you know, about the, you know, every Christmas they have the big war on Christmas panic because, you know, some clerk in some grocery store didn't say Merry Christmas, but only said Happy Holidays. And so we're all supposed to panic and freak out about that. Or last year it was, what, coffee cups, I guess. That was the big thing. And it's like,
I get tired of that stuff.
Oh, I hate it. You know, and a friend of mine was going, it's not Christmas. You know, it's Advent. Why are they freaking out about Christmas? Christmas hasn't even started yet. So stop playing into that dumb culture war thing. And so when it gets to be Christmas, I'm like, I'm taking all 12 days and you can't stop me.
There you go.
And I'm the same way with Easter. It's like, you know, liturgically, it is still Easter Sunday, and it's going to be Easter Sunday until Divine Mercy Sunday, you know, until midnight on Divine Mercy Sunday. And so I'm taking the whole thing. So it's still Easter Sunday as far as I'm concerned, which is part of the reason I'm kind of dinking around on this show and not really working very hard.
Fair enough. Well, how about, you know, you're still feasting, let's say it that way.
That's a little... Absolutely. So, you know, we're playing around, and I just gotta believe that, you know, part of what it must have been like for Jesus on Easter Sunday, I mean, it's always dangerous to psychologize the Son of God. We don't really know his, you know, what's going on in the mind of the incarnate God-man. But I just got to believe that just part of it was like, man, this is fantastic.
I know, that's the thing is that,
this,
I mean,
is awesome.
He's got to be delighted. He's got to, you know, I mean, look, you get in the Gospels, you get Jesus wept, you get, you know, he got angry, you get all kinds of little moments. But what you don't get is Jesus laughed. And if ever there was a time when the world would have broken with joy with God's laughter, it would have been then.
Well, you want to know a little secret, actually?
Go
one
ahead.
Of the names for this is in the East, this is called Bright Monday.
Bright Monday. I like that. That's right.
Well, the whole week is called Bright Week in the Orthodox tradition.
I didn't know that.
Yep. And also, this is also sometimes referred to as God's Laughter Day.
God's Laughter Day. Oh, my goodness.
Isn't that great? Yeah. So in a lot of Eastern European countries, one of the customs, which, with, by the way, we have reproduced with abandon on some Easters here at Shea Shea, is you celebrate this with big, big water fights.
I like it.
Give your kids some water balloons and set them outside and just let them
run. That's liturgically correct. Fire at will.
So we'll be back right after this. You're listening to Connecting Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We're here today with Sherry Antonetti talking about a bright week and Easter and all manner of gallimaufry. And we'll be right back after this.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with Sherry Antonetti and talking about Easter-related things. You know, one of the things that came up in the last week or so, it comes up periodically, especially around this time, there are certain things that they're kind of like, you know, seasonal things that you hear about. So every Christmas, there's always discussions in the press about, you know, how Christmas is really just a warmed over feast of Sol Invictus. You got to have that conversation.
Get your druids out there with their Yule logs to prove that it's not.
Yeah, you got that whole thing. And so one of the things that pops up is the, you know, the reliable meme that comes up is that Ishtar is really pronounced Easter. And so Ishtar was this Babylonian deity, and that's where Easter comes from. Is this?
And it's a really bad movie in 1979 starring Dustin Hoffman.
Terrible. Dustin Hoffman. And anyway, you know, and all this kind of stuff comes up. And when people say, you know, well, Easter is the same word as Ishtar. Okay, first of all, it's just not. It's just not. I can tell you where Easter does come from. It does come from the name of a pagan deity. That pagan deity is Estra. You know, Germanic peoples used, you know, obvious signs of fertility and new life or eggs. Also, you know, little chicks and things like this. Yeah, that's all true. But here's the thing. Easter, the name Easter applied to this feast day is a purely linguistic accident. It's because the gospel comes to Northern Europe. You've got German-speaking people who call this season named after Estra. But you know what? Here's the thing. That doesn't mean that the resurrection is a myth that originated about 1,000 years ago with German-speaking peoples. Here's how I know that. The way I know that is if you go anywhere outside of German or English-speaking peoples, this feast is not called Easter. It's called after some variation of Pascha. Why Pascha? Because that means Passover, because the resurrection happened at Passover. So anywhere else in the Mediterranean world, every variation on, you know, Italian, French, Spanish, you can also go places outside the English-speaking or German-speaking world, and you'll find that it's named after Passover. It's not named after Estra. But here's the other thing. What day of the week is it, Sherry?
Today is Monday, but it's on Sunday.
You must be a moon worshiper. You called today Monday.
Yeah, you're right.
Maybe not, right?
I found out. You know?
That's the thing is, you know, what matters is not this sort of archaeological relic, this linguistic archaeological relic, but what content does that word get filled with? So today is Monday, not because we're moon worshipers, but because that happens to be in the English-speaking world. Those names of those days, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, happen to be leftovers that are no longer contain any of the content of the culture that produced them. So nobody in the English-speaking world worships Odin on Woden's Day. Nobody worships Thor. Nobody worships Freya. Nobody worships Saturday. Nobody worships the sun. And nobody worships the moon. And in the same way, Easter has essentially nothing. The name Easter, the word Easter, has nothing whatsoever to do with the resurrection of Jesus Christ, which happened 1,000 years before the gospel collided with German-speaking culture.
You're upsetting my internet meme with facts.
I know. It's hard to deal with, but there it is. But anyway, that's one of those things that happens. But another thing that also happens, which I think is very interesting, is this is the time of year when people start noticing again probably the single most fascinating relic in Christian civilization, the Shroud of Turin.
Yes.
The Shroud of Turin is just the strangest relic there is. There's nothing like it.
It's been studied so often. It's amazing, all the work that's been done to examine it and x-ray it and carbon date it and
try to figure out what it is. And the longer they look at this thing, the more inexplicable it is. They did a carbon dating on it. So for people who have been living in a cave and not familiar with the Shroud of Turin, the Shroud of Turin is a, I think it's what, about, well, it's essentially, it's the length of two 5'11" men. It's a piece of cloth now hanging in the cathedral at Turin in a carefully, you know, chemically controlled neutral atmosphere kind of thing, where it's been since, I forget, the 14th or 15th century, something like this, and it's absolutely unique. It has an image, the front and back of a crucified man, on a man who's been scourged, who has had wounds to his head that are comport with a crown of thorns. Wounds that don't comport with medieval iconography of crucifixion, but do comport absolutely perfectly with what we actually know about Roman methods of persecution, of crucifixion. And it shows up for certain in the historical record around 1340.
Yes.
When a French knight whose wife is actually descended from crusaders who had participated in the Fourth Crusade, produces this cloth. There are people at the time who think that the cloth is a forgery. So there's always been that suspicion that it might be a forgery. The church, by the way, makes no claim about its genuineness. It's been venerated for centuries. And it's there in the cathedral, and the church, because the church isn't afraid of the truth, says, sure, examine it, take a look at it.
Right? Go for it, yes.
Well, the shroud was known but not widely known for centuries, but things began to change in the late 19th century when photography was invented. And so some guy went and took the very first images of the Shroud of Turin, photographs of the Shroud of Turin. And when he developed the negatives, he was stunned because what he realized he was looking at was a positive photograph that made the image much clearer. The weird thing, first of all, about the image is that it's a photo negative.
Right.
And that's the first question, is why on earth would a medieval forger go to the trouble of making a perfect photo negative of the crucified Jesus? That's weird.
Yes.
And then somebody took a picture of it and said, yikes, this thing looks like a photograph. Yes. And a really perfect photograph of the crucified body of Jesus.
Yes.
And so then in the 20th century with photography, and now with like digital photography and all these ways that you can manipulate the image and derive, you know, one of the things they realized was that you can derive a 3D image out of this image that's on the cloth. And so the mystery surrounding the Shroud of Turin just got deeper and deeper as people looked at this thing and said, this is really freaky. And the weird thing is that there's no, it was not painted.
So how did it get created, which I don't understand?
They don't have a freaking clue how it was created. And that's the thing. I will tell you straight out, I think that it's the genuine article. I always have. And everything that I learn about it just tells me, this is the real thing. This is the burial cloth of Jesus. The image is right on the surface. It's not painted. Paint would have left traces of chemicals, bonding agents, all that kind of thing. None of that. The blood stains on the cloth are blood, B-L-U-D, blood.
A-B type, if you want
to know. A-B type blood, yeah. Yeah, so how did it get there? Well, they don't know. And that's the, you know, the first big challenge to people who say this is a forgery is, my standing challenge to everybody who says it's a forgery is, great, make another one. Knock yourself out, you know. And of course, you have to limit yourself. If you think that the image was created in the middle of the 14th century, then you have to limit yourself to technology.
14th century technique and knowledge.
In the 14th century. But here's the thing. It just gets weirder as you go on, because the great spanner in the works for saying that it's genuine is a carbon dating that was done in 1988, which dated it to within about 40 years of when it shows up in the historical record, placing it, if the carbon dating is right, as having been made, or at least the cloth having been made in the early 14th century. But there are problems with that. And we'll talk about that when we return. You'll see too. I'm Mark Shea, and we'll be back on Redbox Media, the Sherry Antonetti.
If you enjoy listening to Mark Shea and all of his wonderful co-hosts here on Connecting the Dots, then consider becoming a friend of the show and provide your support today. Go to breadboxmedia.com and click on Friend of the Show. Thank you.
Connecting the Dots. It is I, your host, Mark Shea, here with my fair maiden friend, Sherry Antonetti.
Thank you.
Yay, verily, and anon, forsooth. So anyway, we're talking about the Shroud of Turin. So the big argument against the Shroud of Turin is carbon dating.
Yes.
Carbon dating placed it in the 1400s. The thing is that there are other pieces of evidence that are very intriguing. The chief one that is an awfully hard blow against the accuracy of carbon dating is carbon dating has to presume certain things. It has to presume, among other things, a pristine environment for the shroud, which is exactly what the shroud would not have as a liturgical object.
Right.
If the shroud is real, then what it was perpetually exposed to for centuries and centuries is a ton of smoke from candles in shrines. Both if the tracing the history on it is accurate, if it's traceable back to Constantinople, I was in a Byzantine shrine. Byzantine shrines are just tons of smoke all the time.
Electric light not yet invented.
And of course, the same in a Catholic shrine as well. So there's that. But there's another thing that's really crucial is there is another piece of cloth that is associated with the Passion called the Sudarium of Oviedo. Oviedo is not in France. It's in Spain. And the Sudarium is basically a cloth that covered the head of Jesus, according to the tradition surrounding the Sudarium. It also has blood stains on it, type AB, which, by the way, again, every time, and this also happens, by the way, with Eucharistic miracles. Eucharistic miracles, the blood in a Eucharistic miracle is always type AB, which is like, that's odd, you know.
That's very rare.
Yeah, it's an unusual blood type. But with the Sudarium Oviedo, what's interesting is that the Sudarium, the blood stains on the Sudarium of Oviedo and the blood stains on the Shroud of Turin match perfectly.
Yes.
To the point where people who have examined this, experts who have examined this, and there are like super obsessive experts who have been examining, have been studying this thing forever, have pointed out that it's just not possible that it's chance.
Right.
That it's very clear the Sudarium of Oviedo and the Shroud were on the same corpse. They
yes.
just were. And
yes.
that is one of two things. It means either that the medieval forger somehow had access to the Sudarium of Oviedo, and I mean really good access to it, to the point where he was able to make his fake forgery perfectly line up with the wounds on the Sudarium at Oviedo.
He's or
these things are associated with the same victim of crucifixion. Now, the Sudarium at Oviedo has also been carbon dated. And yes. here's the interesting part. The carbon dating says that the Sudarium at Oviedo was made around 700 AD. But we know for certain that the Sudarium at Oviedo is at least 150 years, at least, by the way, 150 years older than that. We can positively date it to about 540 AD. That's where it really starts showing up in the historical record, which means that the carbon dating on the Sudarium at Oviedo is wrong.
Is off.
It is not
yes.
infallible. And that means... What about the carbon dating of
the Shroud of Turin?
Yeah. It's just not a done deal that the carbon dating on the Shroud of Turin is accurate. And what's more, then, is you've got these two items that are linked. We can that means if they really are as linked as they sure look like they are, that means we can at least date the Shroud back to 540 AD. That's a lot closer to the time of Christ.
Yeah.
Can we put it closer than that? Well, the pollen on the thing is from the Holy Land.
Yes.
They've been able to find pollen
not
on it.
Not Spain.
Right, not Spain. Well, and not France.
Right.
We can also, what's interesting is the crusader who owns the Shroud is related by marriage to a woman whose ancestor fought in the Fourth Crusade. Now, the Fourth Crusade was not a happy event for the Byzantines. The basic story of the Fourth Crusade is that Western Crusaders who were... Constantinople was New York City.
Okay.
And medieval France... Well, in 1204, medieval France was Bug Tussle, Oklahoma. And so these yokels who went to the Holy Land, and just at the time they arrived there, the people who were living in Constantinople were engaged in some kind of, one might even call it a Byzantine power struggle. And
That's
said
strange.
To the crusaders, hey, if you'll come and help us against whoever it is they were fighting, then, you know, we would really appreciate it. So they opened the gates of Constantinople to these French crusaders who proceeded to go in and sack the city because they were yokels. The Pope, by the way, was not at all happy with this. And Constantinople never forgot it, never forgave what happened. Because they went in, they sacked the city, they took all this stuff. So, for example, there are lions outside of St. Mark's Cathedral in Venice. Those lions were stolen by Byzantine crusaders and taken away to Venice. There's a lot of stuff in Europe that was still stolen in the Fourth Crusade. Well, one of the crusaders basically kept a diary and remarks on this cool thing that he saw in one of the many churches that was in Constantinople. He said that they had a cloth that bore the image of our Lord. And it was presented upright every Friday for veneration in this church. Now, one of the things that they're able to do is they can see, you can see how the cloth was folded repeatedly. Remember, liturgical item.
Yes.
So there was a specific way that you folded the holy cloth. So there is a series of folds on the cloth until you get to the part which shows the face of Jesus and then down to about where his hands are. And then there's a series of four little folds. Well, what they've done is they basically recreated a device that would have presented the image. And when you fold the cloth so that it will work on this device, the folds on the cloth fit perfectly with how it would work on such a device. And so basically the idea was that it was a series of pulleys that would hoist the cloth up to present the face of Jesus and his upper body. And it would be available. It would be there for veneration for anybody who came into the church.
Right.
Well, if that's the case, that places the Shroud of Turin in 1204 in Constantinople. And so if that's the case, that means the carbon dating is just wrong. And that you're actually looking at that the cloth that is mentioned by this crusader is exactly the same one that shows up in 14th century France. That was stolen then by a French crusader taken to France, and it shows up about a century and a half later in the historical record. This is entirely plausible.
Yes.
And so you keep pushing the date of this cloth back and back. And then eventually the question has to be, well, how accurate is carbon dating? And at the same time, the question is, how did this image get there? And they just do not know. They don't have
That's the question
idea.
They can't answer. They can't
right. prove it. So when I look at it, it's not part of the deposit of faith. You don't have to believe that the Shroud of Turin is the burial cloth of Jesus. But I think, frankly, common sense says, sure looks like the burial cloth of Jesus. I've seen desperate attempts to say, well, how do we know it's Jesus? It might be just some other crucified guy. And it's like,
it was cursed in the side and wore a crown of thorns.
Crown of thorns, you know. I mean, it's such a perfect representation. But
that's why, Christine. It's a perfect.
But that's the thing, it doesn't correspond to medieval iconography standards. It corresponds to what we actually know about how Romans conducted crucifixion. So the nails are through the wrists. The nails are through the heel bone.
Yes.
That's exactly how it was actually done. And nobody in the 14th century would know that because crucifixion was banned a thousand years earlier because Christianized Roman Empire could not bring itself to execute people in the same way that Jesus had been executed. Mm-hmm. So paintings done at the same period don't fit with what the Shroud of Turin shows us. They fit with what the historical data actually tells us about how real crucifixion was conducted. I think it's the real thing. Sherry Antonetti, I want to thank you so much for being on the show today.
My pleasure.
We have been and will remain connecting the dots, not two dorks laughing at our own jokes. I want to thank Danny Head for being a producer. And we will be back tomorrow with Sister Rose Picot. And we'll see you then. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.